Tonight on Arena, Morbius, The Bubble and True Things are the movies up for review, and Cormac Begley on the variety of concertinas used on his second solo album, B. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night is, as always, movie night here in Arena. And this evening we bring you a Marvel-adjacent vampire superhero, an isolated woman falling passionately for an awful man, and a collection of pampered actors secluded in a country estate and making a monster movie. Morbius is and isn't a Marvel film. It stars Jared Leto in mercifully restrained form as a genius doctor who uses his own body to test a vampire bat-derived treatment for a rare blood disease. I wonder what could possibly go wrong. It's based on the Marvel original comic book stories, but this is a Sony picture and not part of the MCU. That's Marvel Cinematic Universe to you and me. Confused? Well, I'm hoping Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty will be able to enlighten us. Ruth Wilson and Tom Burke bring us True Things, the story of a lonely woman who's drawn to an unpredictable but magnetic charmer. And with The Bubble, writer-director Judd Apatow, makes the pandemic-set ensemble comedy we really don't know we need it. As I said, Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty have been taking a look at the films and they're with me this evening. Let's start with the big release of the week, Morbius. This is the latest from the Marvel stable. Biochemist Michael Morbius, played by Jared Leto, decides to grasp the old adage, physician, heal thyself. Paul, who is Morbius and where do we find, where does he fit in to the Marvel world?
Well, you mentioned earlier Marvel adjacent, Sean, which is a very good way of putting it. Spider-Man, like a star footballer, is out on loan to Sony and has been for some time. And this is also Spider-Man adjacent because he originally appeared, Morbius, as a kind of foe in the Spider-Man things. He's a very unfortunate fellow. We first meet him in a Greek orphanage where for a little a specialist hospital for people with this rare blood disease. And he meets this character called Milo there, who's played by Matt Smith in the film. And basically, he becomes this brilliant biochemist and scientist. And as you say, his wish now is to cure himself because he's slowly dying, he's degenerating, and he hits upon a very novel solution.
Cara, is that setup in Greece, is that really a kind of a prologue to the movie, or how important is that in the action, in setting up the action that comes afterwards?
It's really important in that this is where the two young boys meet and that friendship becomes incredibly important. But it's not really explained in this. The fact that Morbius is Greek is quite big in the comics and his whole history there, but they've just sort of thrown it in here. But he does meet a doctor who's played by Jared Smith, Emil Nichols, who becomes a really kind of central figure in both of their lives. He's a bit of a kind of a father figure who stays with them when they're older, and he takes care of Matt Smith character Milo, who is, when he grows up, he's a rich kid who really can't mind himself at all. Nothing to do with his condition. He's a bit of an immature. So it's really important to meet that character, but they kind of just throw the Greek thing in there without real context as to why.
Paul, then there's a Dr. Martina Bancroft here as well. She's about to, in the clip we'll hear shortly, she's about to give him an injection. Is she vital to the plot, or is this really her function, give him the injection and get off the set?
Well, you might be right there, Sean. She's also a kind of love interest, as they used to say, and she is Morbius' closest friend,
played
as it were,
by
and colleague, played by Adria Arjona. And she facilitates this experiment, though she has misgivings, as several rats have died in the build-up to it. But it goes ahead and things go badly wrong.
Right, well, let's listen to the scene then where Dr. Martina Bancroft and Adria Arjona is injecting Morbius with the bat blood.
This could be my last chance.
You can buckle me up.
Yeah. Great.
Moment of truth.
Oh, yeah, Yes. It's never a good idea to inject yourself with bat blood, I would have thought. And I think that's what Morbius I played there with Jared Leto and injected by Adria Arjona, as Dr. Martina Bancroft is about to find out. Cara, this film delayed for 3 years. That's never a good thing. And I know there has been a pandemic in the meantime, and perhaps this idea of injecting with bat blood was part of the reason for the delay. Do you think there may have been other reasons?
I think whatever the reasons were, they should have just kept on with the delay and decided, you know what, we're just going to draw a line under this and, you know, either wait until Marvel can buy back Morbius and do the character justice and not let the good people at Sony sort of play with them and make a bit of a bat's ear of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought you might be of the opinion that it should have been held over. Okay. Jared Leto here, Paul. Yeah. I mean, the last thing I remember particularly watching him in is his portrayal of Paolo Gucci in House of Gucci.
Oh, yeah.
And
holy God.
He was a little bit over the top for one scene, and for the rest of it, he was miles over the top.
Yes.
What's he doing here?
He's abandoned his method technique, hooray, because, you know, all his performances, most of them are weighed down by that technique, I think. And he's actually quite good in this. Mm. He deserves a better film. He's quite relaxed. He's sort of almost charming as opposed to this kind of heavy thing that he does. And he is not the problem. And neither are any of the actors. The actors, Matt Smith is perfectly fine. He's not given enough to do. The problem is that it's all quite perfunctory. It's in the same territory as Venom, which was treated with similar disrespect. The effects are okay to begin with, but then they start throwing effects into it towards the end of the end. It ends in this very unseemly fashion. I thought that, you know, that something had gone wrong. It just ended very suddenly, I thought.
And despite the fact, Cara, that you were saying perhaps it shouldn't have seen the light of day at all, or should have gone to Marvel to get it made properly, I think when it started out, the opening whatever, first act possibly of the film, things were looking okay to you.
They did, yeah. I mean, there's good chemistry between the two of them. They have this friendship there, and it's quite interesting. We don't usually see characters with disabilities or illness portrayed on screen. You can really see the bond, the wanting to heal themselves and sort everything out. But very quickly, it just dissolves into nonsense. I mean, Morbius accidentally eats a whole load of people because he's a vampire now. He gets a conscience about that and says, oh no, I'm not going to eat any more people. But the police want him. And at one point, this is the most wanted man in America, and he's sitting in a diner in front of everybody with a very distinctive man bun, and nobody notices him, despite the fact that he's on the cover of every newspaper and the 6-1 news saying wanted more mad bat vampire man is on the loose. And he's just sitting there having a coffee with your woman. Did anybody think this through at all?
Daniel, the director here, Espinosa, isn't it? Is it his fault, perhaps, Paul?
Not to descend to personals, Sean, but I think that, as Cara said, I found it, you know, vaguely competent for the first hour or so. I thought it was okay because I was expecting any film that's been delayed for that long, as you expect, you know, it starts to smell a bit. But actually, it was perfectly okay. The setup was okay, and the effects when they came were not overwhelming. But then it just all goes bananas. Great chemistry too between Jared Leto and the bats, I thought, Cara. But it just all falls to bits, really. To be honest with you, it's got nothing. It's got no personality, actually, I don't think.
Oh,
really.
Dear, staying with you then, Paul. Vaguely competent. It doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement. How does it translate into stars?
You don't see that on movie posters very often.
No.
Vaguely competent. I would say it would be the 2 stars for me, Sean, I'm afraid.
2 stars for you, and overall from you then, Cara. You're in a similar place, I think.
I am going to go for the very rarer than the 5-star. I am giving this thing 1. Because, God, you know, God, what? I just can't give it any more than that. And I'm the target audience for anything related to superheroes and vampires. So, you know, but just no. No.
Was there one particular aspect that earned the 1 star?
The performances at the start and poor old Jared Harris having very little to do, but he did it very well.
Yeah,
he did, yeah.
All right, very little to do, but did it very well. And 1 star and 2 star, respectively, then, for Morbius. Let's move on to Harry Wycliffe, whose 2018 film Only You offered viewers a grown-up love story. Her latest film. True Things is also on the surface a love story, but one that might have been better avoided by its central character, Kate, played by Ruth Wilson. Cara, Kate, as we meet her, is a rather aimless young woman, to say the very least, trying with difficulty to hold down a new job at a welfare office and getting a lot of abuse in the process of that job as well. And then in comes a handsome stranger.
Indeed. The job she isn't happy with, all of her friends have settled down and she's not ready to, she doesn't want to get married, she doesn't want to do the whole kids thing, not yet anyway. She just, this isn't the life she wants to lead. And in waltzes, Tom Burke, he's referred by his hair, she refers to him as blonde, and he is exceptionally magnetic. He half jokingly asks her out as he fills out his welfare forms. She says yes, and within a very short hello, how are you doing, they're at it in a car park in front of the view of everybody who could walk past, and they're just caught up in this whirlwind of chemistry and passion.
And that chemistry, Paul, I really marvelled at. They've so little, in fact, in their opening scene together. Yeah. But almost from the minute he sits down at the table with the most unattractive blonde hair, it has to be said, in the world, to my mind.
I think he gets away with it, Sean.
Yeah, he can pull anything off with that guy. But the minute that they start even looking at each other, the chemistry that these two actors manage to convey is extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Harry Woodliffe is very lucky to have two such charismatic, exceptional actors working for. Yeah, they do. I think the interesting thing is that she is bored, and I think she knows, like, she's not an idiot. She's in Margate, which is a sort of dowdy port town in Kent. Her life is going nowhere. Her mother is hinting darkly about grandchildren, which she has no intention of providing. And then this guy comes in, and she knows he's bad, but she just can't help herself.
And Cara mentioned the car park earlier on. Well, here are Ruth Wilson and Kate, as Kate rather, and Tom Burke as blonde, canoodling is what I will say they are doing on a sunny day near a lake. And this is the conversation between the two.
I don't know anything about you.
I don't know anything about you. My hobbies are reading and listening to music.
I like drawing.
Really?
Yeah. Do you have a girlfriend?
No, I don't have a girlfriend.
Do you do this sort of thing often?
You're interrogating me, Miss Parkin.
Have you ever killed anybody?
It's only in 4 months. You're funny.
Am I?
You know you are.
And that's Tom Burke and Ruth Wilson in a scene there from True Things. Cara, I spoke with Paul there about the chemistry that's between the two of them. Essentially, in some ways, they're both feckless characters and you could get very annoyed at them. Again, these two actors managed to, well, for me anyway, I didn't get as annoyed at them as I might have thought I would.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he turns out to be quite a, I was about to call him a bat bag because I was thinking of the bats from earlier, a rat bag. because they're so wonderful and just so able to draw an audience in, you kind of forgive them a lot. But then he starts to be very cold and callous, and it reaches a point where she is fully immersed in his world and can't really escape that. And one word of coldness or look of ice and he can just cut her down. And at that point, you're just thinking, right, your charm, your magnetism, it's worked to a certain extent, but when you're looking in, you're like, oh god, this man is not good. But it's too late for her. She is trapped in the magnetism that he has. I mean, he really has just this incredible allure, but he has this very, very dark side as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I've praised, and both of you have praised the actors twice at this stage, Paul, but we can't ignore Harry Woodcliffe, and particularly, I suppose, her previous outing, Only You, very accomplished work. She's continuing on that path.
She is. I'm not sure this is quite as good as Only You. It might sort of lack substance towards the end, and might have done more so had she not had the two actors she has at her disposal. I think it's very nicely done for the most part. It's quite gloomy and grim, but it has a sort of poetry to it as well. And I think that I find him more ambivalent, perhaps. I think that at one point he says, she asks him, so where did you grow up then? Or who did you grow up with then? And he replies, various. So you get the feeling that he's rejecting before he gets rejected and is terrified of any kind of commitment, even if he might want it. So he's really a vacuum. All he can do is seduce people and then that's it.
And Margate is that seaside setting for the most of the film, Cara. But then in the final third of the film, there's a move of location to Spain. What did that do to the kind of, suppose, the tone of the film? Did it change enormously? Did we lose something or did we gain something?
I think initially it's a really interesting idea. I mean, he has shown no signs of committing to her. Then this opportunity comes to go to Spain and she's thinking maybe things are changing here. But there's, without spoiling, the way that things are wrapped up, I think it's just a little bit too tidy. These are very messy characters and I don't think that she would have the ability to settle so quickly into a different sort of routine and to find so it's either she's having this time and things are going to be a mess when she goes back to Margate, maybe, but I think it's just a little bit too tidy for the type of film that it is.
Yeah, I wanted something a little bit messier, I must say, at the end myself as well. And mentioning, I suppose, here important as well for the supporting cast, Paul Hayley Squires plays the friend Alison,
and great.
Frank McCusker, Irish actor, our own Frank McCusker, as her father, as Ruth Wilson's father.
That's right, yeah. And her parents, I mean, her parents are exasperated and, you know, from the outside you can understand it, but she just hears that they're getting at her and that she's a disappointment to them. So she's determined to run away from them and they hover a bit. Yeah, the support, I thought Hayley Squires was very good, actually. I like her anyway. And she also is exasperated because this is her best friend and she just thinks, what's the point? Lots of people don't like their jobs, but she doesn't be prepared. She doesn't seem to be prepared even to commit to that, you know.
Yeah, and she even tries to set her up with a very sensible date, and people can see what happens when she goes on that sensible date. It kind of goes wrong, that's for sure. Stars overall. Let's go to you for a judgment first on this one, Cara. Stars for Harry Wycliffe's Only You.
Do you know, just based on that ending slightly falling down, I'm going to do a poll here and I'm going to go for 3.5. The performances really are exceptional and I just thought it just needed a bit more. So I'm sorry to steal Paul's line there, but 3.5.
3.5. And True Things is the film we're reviewing. Only You was the previous one. True Things, 3.5 from you, Cara. What are you saying overall, and stars, Paul?
Well, Cara stole my line and my rating. I was going to give it 3.5 stars as well. I enjoyed a lot of it, but I thought that it lacked substance ultimately. But it's worth seeing for those two. They're wonderful in it.
Yeah, okay. That's True Things, a second of our three movies. And moving on then to The Bubble. A kind of B-list ensemble of cast reassembles. This is within the actual story of the film.
Not the actors, Sean.
Yes, the actors all here are great, but they're playing B-list actors. They reassemble in an English country manor to film the sixth installment of their trashy monster movie franchise, Cliff Beasts. However, the pandemic is forcing them to bubble, an extreme situation that nobody copes with well. The setup here, first of all, Cara, written and directed by Judd Apatow. The cast: Leslie Mann, Pedro Pascal, David Duchovny, Keegan-Michael Day, Kate McKinnon, and on and on and on and on. It really is an extraordinary A-list of cast playing B-list characters.
It is, and I think that's one of the reasons why they all work so well as those characters, because they're such talented actors bringing that level of badness to them. Pedro Pascal is playing this absolute loony called Dieter, who is even hard to explain him. He's just one of those characters that need to be seen, but he has to put on this accent. He already has an accent, and then he has to put on this mutant accent when he's acting as his character. And to be able to do that so badly, you have to be good.
yeah. I suppose the bubble set up here. I did wonder, are we a bit too close to the pandemic to be already be making a comedy about it? But however, that's what they're doing. Let's hear wonderful voice here and the very funny Peter Serafinovich, as he's the producer of the film. And in this opening sequence, he's explaining to everybody how it's all going to work. A little bit of crudeness in the midst of all of this. And we did shorten it down a little bit as well.
Gunther, Bulla, thank you for joining us here in our bubble. As the producer on this movie, here's what I expect from you. Actors are animals. You are animal handlers. Sometimes they want to play with you. Sometimes they'll rip your balls off.
Don't listen to anything they say. They're liars. They literally lie for a living. That's their literal job, yeah?
Don't party with them. Don't tire them out. Always tell them they're fantastic in the movie.
They're very insecure people. They need constant praise.
Any questions?
What if we become proper friends?
You won't.
No?
No.
What if they, like, confide in you and they tell you something they've not told anybody else?
Call me and tell me what they said.
And what if they say, don't tell Gavin?
No!
No.
This is the bubble, the sanctuary. It's the only place they're safe.
That's Peter Serafinovich as the producer, Danielle Vitalis, Gunther, played by Harry Trevaldwin. They're being told how to manage the talent in this particular situation. Paul, it's poor old actors getting a very hard time. Actors really do get maltreated here.
That's very accurate, as far as I remember. Yes, yep.
You think that this is true to form? I'm going to have to defend the acting profession, I'm afraid.
No, I think that everybody's having a lot of fun here. You mentioned Peter Serafinovich. What a lovely voice he has to listen to. But Judd Apatow's films can be afflicted by a certain smugness sometimes. I'm not really sure why or if it's intentional, but there's none of that here. This was made during a lockdown, so there was a kind of lockdown involved. And it does two things very well. It sends up the film industry, which always needs sending up, as we saw the other night. But it also reminds us, and I know we're quite close to it, of what those early lockdowns were like and how paranoid everybody was and what awful things happen when groups of people are left in the same place together for any period of time.
Yeah, so at one level, the lockdown and the pandemic is the kind of hook in here. Then a whole load of other stuff starts to come in as well, Cara. Not least of which is making the sixth film in a pretty awful franchise.
Right, yeah, so there's a lot of the filming within the film. So we see these amazing sets, we see them in action, and it pulls back and you see it's green screen and it's actors dangling on wires. But the problem is, aside from the fact that they've all gone a bit stir crazy, bubbling together, it really is a very unsafe set. Their stunt manager wouldn't be allowed to manage a herd of pigs. The COVID protocols aren't been followed. There's an outbreak of the flu, and things start to go wrong bit by bit. And one of the actors, played by Karen Gillan, Carol, she knows this isn't safe. She's suggesting a coup, that they need to get some help, they need to break free. But of course, if they do anything or say anything, they're going to look like spoiled actors who are moaning about being on set and their hardships. And the others are like, no, we're not doing this. And there's a rift between them, and bit by bit, they all just really start to lose whatever marbles they had left.
Yeah, and Leslie Mann, of course, here playing the wife of one of the actors in the franchise as well. David Duchovny plays Dustin's. He's playing Dustin, and he is interceding here on her behalf. Referring to the logic of the script, Leslie Mann as Lauren, and you'll also hear in this clip Fred Armisen as Darren, who is the director of the particular scene.
Darren, one note before we move on. I mean, I don't get when Dolly says, "Well, somebody taught them how to fly." I mean, they're cliff beasts. It's in their DNA. That's what they do. They fly.
You cannot rewrite my lines. You're not the writer.
But it goes against dinosaur logic.
I don't understand why you're rewriting the script. We have a writer. Aren't you an actor?
Yes, but I'm also the guardian of the franchise. That's why I'm rewriting it.
Well, we have somebody.
Can we play to the top of our audience's intelligence?
No, our audience is down here. They're kids. That's our audience.
Don't listen to him. He just doesn't want me to have the big crowd applause line.
Lauren, all of your lines will be big applause lines if movie theaters ever open again.
If movie theatres ever open again, which was kind of one of the real worries that people had during the pandemic. Obviously, Peter Serafinovich again at the very end of that. But we had David Duchovny as Dustin, Leslie Mann as Lauren, and Fred Armisen as the director of the film. The husband and wife, the Duchovny man, they're they're on again, off again, on again, off again. And they have an adopted son, a son that they adopted, I think, 2 years previously when he was 15 or 16.
Yes.
He says at one point in a Zoom call to them, I don't like films. They're too long. This film is 2 hours long, Paul.
Yes, it is. And normally comedies should not be 2 hours long. And in fact, all Judd Apatow films are 2 hours long or longer. Mm. But I did not mind this. I was having a lot of time, such a good time watching it. During that Zoom call with his parents, that poor kid who'd been adopted 6 months before, a year before, whatever, David Comedy's character says, "Ever wonder if we picked the right kid?" And he can hear. And he says, "Do you think that cat drowned itself?" So it's just great fun. And it actually, in fairness to the actors, it also shows the misery of those kind of sets. Like, they look ridiculous, as Cara said, when you see the green screen they're hanging about. It's not the dignity of labour or anything like it. And it drags on and on, and you get these big, announcements, day 169, like it's just dragging on and on and getting worse and worse and worse.
Well, Paul certainly wasn't bothered by the 2 hours or thereabouts. What about you, Cara? I thought there was a great story with the pandemic, great story with a franchise going on and on, but was there just a bit too many side plots?
They could have lopped out. Call me squeamish. I'm not the biggest fan of, shall we say, when people vomit on screen. There was a little bit too much of that for me, which is a Judd Apatow thing. I mean, he has had it before. So you could have, hinted at that a little bit more, cut a couple of those sorts of scenes out. But it's a very funny film. And it's very clever. So I was about to say we'll forgive them some vomiting, but that sounds a bit disturbing. So. We'll just block out those scenes.
All right. So I think even though it's long, you didn't mind. You seem to be in the same boat as Paul on that one. Stars, first of all, from you on this one, Cara.
I'm having a debate with myself. I still haven't fully decided. There's part of me that would almost want to give it 4, but I'm like, have I gone a bit bubbly and lost it a bit? Should it be more of a Paul Whittington 3.5? We'll go. I'm doing a Paul again. I'm sorry, Paul. I'm going with the 3.5. Three and a half.
I'm going with 3.5. Paul Whittington, do not tell me 3.5.
No, all of me wanted to give it 4 stars, so I will give it 4 stars. Oh. I thought it was great fun. And there are some lovely cameos in it, by the way, from various people. Benedict Cumberbatch, very briefly. John Lithgow, John Cena, Beck. It's great fun.
Yeah, now there are lots of cameos in there, as you say, that are fun. All right, Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty there speaking to us about our three films this evening. Morbius goes on general release in cinemas today. True Things is released in selected cinemas from tomorrow, and also tomorrow, The Bubble will be available on Netflix. Cormac Begley is a concertina player from West Kerry. Plays 13 concertinas that range from bass to piccolo register. The music from his latest solo album, simply called B, central to the award-winning show Mom, directed by Michael Keegan Dolan, and also to Pat Collins' film The Dance. 2022 has already been a busy year for Cormac. Performance in Dubai for St. Patrick's Day, collaborations with artists the like of Stephen James Smith, in fact, speaking to us about his album just the other night, and Ye Vagabonds, as well as Cormac's own solo tour coming up. Delighted that Cormac Begley joins us now. Own studio, M. Malian and all. Fáilte róid, Anocht, Cormac. I thought, he's only given us one letter, but the letter B stands for an awful lot of things in the world of Cormac Begley, not least of which is Begley.
Yes. B stands for a lot of different things, but for me, I guess B is is for the word baile, like home, and where this album was recorded. But it also stands for Beaglioch Begley, Bailin Rú of Rick, and Brook Badger, from the townland in West Kerry that both my parents came from. And B for bass. I play 2 bass concertinas on this album.
The bass concertina, and I had the joy of watching you play that bass concertina in studio. It's a huge instrument, and it's very physical, a very physical act playing it, Cormac.
It is. It's a big instrument. It's a heavy instrument, and it takes a lot of energy and pressure to get some of the reeds to sound. And you have to manage, I guess, the pressure. If you exert too much pressure, some of the notes don't sound at all. So it's a bit of a tightrope in terms of continuing the tempo and the rhythm of the tune.
And you use this idea that, you know, some of the time if you get the pressure wrong, that the notes won't sound, so you get the kind of the sound of air. And do the key, are the keys of the instrument, can they also make quite a kind of percussive sound as well? You're doing this very consciously, I think, at times.
Yes, yeah, you can get a percussive sound, just like a dancer dance and step dancing, on the buttons, with your fingers hitting off the buttons. You can also get percussive sounds from the air, and even kind of bellow smacks, getting like with enough force, you can smack the bellows to create a kind of a drum sound, like a boweron.
Well, listen, we listened to a track called To War, which is the second track on the album, and I think lots of the effects that you've just described are within it, and this is from Cormac Begley and his new album, B. So sounds like this is about five of you playing that instrument, to be fair, Cormac, and a couple of dancers dancing alongside you. But that is just you, Cormac Begley, and one of the bass concertinas. That clickety clackety sound that we heard at the end, that was the keys that you were talking about beforehand, was it? Yeah,
yeah, that's just holding the concertina without kind of putting any pressure on the bellows and clicking the buttons enough that you're not activating a reed.
I guess that dance element, and it's very much to there in that track To War from the album. A lot of the music that we're getting on this is from the show Mom, and also as we saw in the Pat Collins documentary, The Dance. Was it about taking that music out from the Mom's, I suppose, context and looking at it afresh, or what was your idea there, Cormac?
Well, truth be told, I was going to start. I had intentions to start recording the bass album back during the time of the creation of Mom. So I brought a lot of these tunes to Mom, and which was documented by Pat. And then COVID hit, and I had already started, I think, with Jack Talty done Missy Casey. But when COVID hit, I was here at home for the past 2 years, and I guess it's been my COVID project to revisit these tunes. And I've gotten to know them, I guess, very well over the last 2 years, and especially during the production Mom, where we've toured a lot with that. And
It's heading out on tour again quite soon, Mom. Will you be heading out with it?
I will. We're going to Wiesbaden in May, I think, 17th and 18th. And I think there's talk of a tour, an Irish tour, at some point this year, but that's yet to be announced.
It struck me, watching the Pat Collins documentary, just how integral the music was to Mom, and how really the two things, the show and the music, grew together in a totally and absolutely organic way. How unusual an experience is that for you?
Well, it's a very special experience, and working with Michael Keegan Dolan, especially, and the dancers and the group Stargaze as well. We were immersed in Fiona Hall, which is just a couple of miles over the road from here. place, Hull, where I got my first shift at the age of 11. And I ended up being there for 8 weeks, immersed with these dancers and musicians and playing. And I still imagine them, when I play some of these tunes, I can still see the dancers moving and their movement, which fits so naturally to traditional music.
And by the way, I should have said it when we were listening to War, the track, that was written by your godson.
It was written for my godson.
Oh, for your godson, yeah. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, my godson lives over the road. His name is Soren.
What age is he?
He's 3 years old.
And he's not writing the music yet.
Yeah, not yet. No. But his name means, it's a Viking name, which means God of War. Mm. And so for his birthday, I wrote that tune for him.
Yeah, no, what a joy that. And I would love to see his reaction, particularly to those rhythmic sections.
Well, on the dance documentary, Pat's documentary, he's actually in the audience when we did the performance in Hall na Fionaí. Mm. And he loves the music, and he was particularly excited about seeing the show, Mom.
Yeah. We were speaking to Stephen Jim Smith earlier in the week, and we played the track An Ode to Tony McMahon's Den. A really lovely way that yourself and Stephen collaborated on that, although I was surprised to hear that you were down below in Kerry and he was up here. Well, he's in Wexford, in fact, not in Dublin. But that reference to that, do you remember the specifics of the party he speaks about in the poem up in Tony McMahon's den, Tony McMahon's house, and yourself and Steve Cooney were there?
Very well, I do. It was my first time playing with Steve, and I was honoured to be asked by Tony to play in his house. And there's a lovely gathering of people, but there's a very kind of excited energy in the room. And I even remember Stephen, I remember where he was sitting, and I could remember most people in the room. And it was just kind of, there's a great atmosphere, a kind of electric feeling in the room. And just an honour to play for people like the Tony, and having a host of artists around. It's a very special night and something I really vividly remember.
Yeah, and it struck me, I mean, because it's so much in Stephen's poem and in the piece that we heard, it's so much about the session, it's about the group, it's about the gathering. This is a solo album. It's a very unusual kind of project in some ways for a traditional musician to be out there doing it totally and absolutely by yourself.
It is, and I guess it's very challenging in that respect, but it gives a lot of leeway, especially the bass itself. It's a rare enough instrument, and probably one of the few people that play bass concertina in the world, which gave me a lot of freedom in approaching the album compared to my debut album, which is when I play a range of instruments. But it is a challenge. I do supplement my I guess gigs with playing with other musicians, and I love collaborating with people, but when you're a solo musician, you're the conductor as well as the musician, the composer, and it kind of book stops with you, and there's a lot of pressure with that.
Yeah, for sure.
But there's a lot of freedom in that, and independence, and I crave that. I created that in my career, to be honest. So.
Yeah, and you'll be heading out on tour with it. And by the way, I should say that the album itself is The Shape of the Concertina. That's a little, I presume, a little nod back to Horselips and Happy to Meet, Sorry to Part, that album.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I recorded my first album 5 years ago, and I got help with a few friends, a guy called Killian O'Mungo, a concertina player, and Sarah Flynn, who took the photos. And I was running an arts course, concertina course, down at home, and which Killian was attending, and I didn't know about the Horselips album until I had released it.
There you go.
And then afterwards, obviously, people pointed that out. But this, the latest one is a bigger version of the debut album.
All right, yeah, because I suppose you've two instruments to be showing off in some ways in this particular cover. Let's finish up by listening to the opening track on the album. In fact, Cormac, Rolling in the Barrel, O'Neill's March in Tralee Jail. We'll get to part of that. You told a great anecdote around the Begleys, and in particular, I suppose, Marshall O'Neill. Maybe you'd remind us of that. You told this anecdote as part of the dance.
Yeah, well, Begley Beog stands for small and Leich stands for warrior or hero. So my ancestors were small warriors or mercenary galloglasses that came over from Scotland and fought on behalf of the O'Neill clan and O'Donnell clan. And just before the Battle of Kinsale, these galloglasses joined other Leichs like the Crowleys or Dooleys, Dovleichs, Moyenleys, gentle warriors, went down to Cork and fought at the Battle of Kinsale, and the Irish ultimately lost that battle. And as a result of that, Begley's ended up in West Kerry. So that's my ancestor line.
And just one final thing before we go into the piece of music and itself. You have several tour dates for around the country. In fact, you're heading off to Europe as well, but particularly in the early part of April. I'll give people details of where they can find those dates out. And where can they get the album, Cormac?
Well, it's going to be on pre-order tomorrow morning. It's going to be available on Bandcamp, and all the links will be on my website and social media accounts. So it's going to be on pre-order tomorrow and released after the tour. I have a Kerry launch in Dingle, part of Fair in the Beltan, and a Dublin launch in Daly Mount Park on the 13th. So after my tour and after those official launches, I'll be sending out the albums.
All right. Well, listen, Gonairi Lat, Leshan Thoris, Agus Leshan, Leshan Kernin, our father,
and
Gormila Makat, as Vetla Manok, Cormac Begley on Shin, and let's listen to the opening, or a little bit of the opening track on his new album, B, Rolling in the Barrel, O'Neill's March, and Tralee Jill. Cormac Begley, Rolling in the Barrel, O'Neill's March, and a little bit of Tralee Jill, and that all from his new album, B. Pre-ordered, as Cormac told us, can be pre-ordered from tomorrow, and all of his tour dates and details of how to do that on his website, cormacbegley.com. When Belfast artist Daniel O'Neill died in 1974, his paintings were still fetching top prices for the time. But with no one to manage his estate and talk of forgeries on the market, his reputation drifted somewhat into obscurity. In his heyday, especially in the 1940s and 50s, his portraits and landscapes were internationally acclaimed, very much in popular demand. Art historian Karen Rehill published a book about O'Neill in 2020, the centenary of his birth, and she has now curated a retrospective, Daniel O'Neill, Romanticism and Friendships, which is at the Farmley Gallery in Dublin's Phoenix Park. And I'm delighted to have Karen with us in studio this evening. And we will tweet some images of O'Neill's paintings as we're talking here. You'll find them on at RTE Arena as we go along. Maybe first of all, Karen, tell me a little bit about O'Neill himself and how you became interested in his work.
I first became interested in Daniel O'Neill about 15 years ago when I was researching another Belfast painter, Gerard Dillon. And that really drew me in, I suppose. Mm. And but I decided to start with Gerard Dillon, then George Campbell, and then I finally came to Daniel O'Neill. And but my relationship with Daniel O'Neill grew over the years, and I became very emotionally connected to him.
To the work. I was saying in the introduction, you know, look how commercially successful he was in his day. Let's tweet an image, and maybe you can tell me about what it is about these images, that how specific it is to O'Neill himself. We'll tweet an image now of The Marriage, that particular painting, at RTE Arena, if you want to have a look at it. It does exactly what it says in the tin here, Karen.
Well, it's also known, the other title it's known by is The Wedding. But what's so fascinating about this picture is actually the way that Daniel O'Neill has applied the paint onto the canvas.
We're seeing is we see the bride and the groom looking straight at us in the church in the background. So tell me a little bit about the way the paint is applied. Is this part of his appeal?
Well, he's the only painter I know that used to use an icing bag, really. He used to push the paint into the icing bag, and literally you can see her dress.
Yeah.
The way that her dress, all those little sort of
tiny little details, like
lacing.
Yeah, like icing on a cake.
It is like icing on a cake.
And is it acrylic?
It's actually oil. No, this is about 1947, this painting. And so he would have been using oils, but he spent a great deal of time experimenting with paint. And this is one of his characteristics in the 1940s, is this lacing effect. And there's several paintings in the exhibition that if you look at them in detail, you'll actually see this effect, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, well, as you say, I mean, it is that lace effect is very much like the kind of decoration that you might see the icing on a cake, so it makes sense. Did he maintain that icing bag technique throughout his career?
Once he travelled to Paris in 1948, he spent 6 months there. His painting changed his style after he was exposed to the modern European painters. When he came back, his style radically changed. But he did like to experiment. He never really stayed in one style for very long.
Yeah, let's tweet another image at this point, which maybe gives us a sense of one of the changes that took place. This is a painting called Girl from the North at RTE Arena. Is it North Country, in fact, or is it just Girl from the North? Girl from the North is the title of the painting itself. Very blue. Blues and greens, a kind of midnight, nighttime feel to this. No icing, it doesn't look as if there's any icing cake involved here.
Well, you see the palette knife, in the background, you see along the sky area, you'll see that he's actually used a palette knife.
Yeah, almost scraping the paint across the canvas.
And he always starts to use a palette knife right throughout the 1950s and even into the 1960s. That's a technique he maintained.
And that kind of facial structure, I mean, very oval-shaped face, a very oval at the chin, and the almond-shaped eyes, that's very similar to the bride that we saw in the first painting in some
ways,
isn't it?
Well, the bride is actually a rounder face, and that is actually his muse, his wife, Eileen. Mm. And this picture is dated around 1951, and at this point his marriage has collapsed, and this is his partner, his new partner, Sheila Deacon.
And when we hear Girl from the North here, are we talking about the North being up Northern Ireland?
Northern Ireland. Well, she was from Downpatrick, and that's where they lived for a period before they moved to a little cottage on Torella Beach, which is where you'll actually see, again, he uses her in most of his beach scenes in the 1950s.
He spent time then in London, and then he was painting Belfast after the riots from 1970, and that Belfast after the riots is one of the paintings. And again, we'll tweet that now at RTE Arena. How political a painter was he in that respect when he starts writing about or painting Belfast after the riots?
Well, he used to go to the civil rights meetings in Belfast during the Troubles, at the start of the Troubles, 1969. And he was very worried about his mother and sister. And that's why, one of the main reasons why he came back to live in Belfast.
And when we look at this painting, notable given the previous two that we've looked at, is the absence of a person here. It's just the shell of a building.
It's very surreal. Mm. Well, this is supposedly is a hosier's yard off the Falls Road, and it was burnt during those terrible riots in August 1969. And seemingly Dan O'Neill walked around the area. And this is the hosier's yard that he would have known throughout his childhood. Mm. And it really obviously, this was his personal and emotional response to the painting. And it's very, I find it's quite uncanny in a way, because it's not like any other painting I've ever known him to paint, because it has this very architectural sort of surreal feeling. Yeah.
And again, I'll just put up one final painting then, Divorce and Departure at RTE Arena. Again, if you want to look at this, you talked about surreal there. We're not quite in a surreal world here, but it's an interesting kind of composition. Four different figures at different points along the way. We're certainly not in a world of realism, Karen.
This is very autobiographical, this painting, and it's one of his last works. It's dated 1973, and it was in his last group show, and it shows Maureen going from the left to the right, Maureen, Sheila, his daughter Patricia, and then his wife Eileen. And it's quite a sad story, actually, because the woman on the right is his wife, Eileen, and she had to leave Belfast. And that's why it's Divorce and Departure. It's very dramatic in reality. So
yeah, even looking at it on the screen, it has that kind of inbuilt drama into it. So we can see a lot of his paintings then in Farmley. How many will we get to see?
You'll see 40 of his pictures, and you'll see also his friends in the next gallery, which Gerard Dillon, George Campbell and Colin Middleton.
Right, so it has a context to it. That's it. Karen Rehill, thanks for coming in to us this evening, Karen. And the exhibition, Daniel O'Neill, Romanticism and Friendships, is at the Farmley Gallery. It's there until the 6th of June. Farmley.ie will give you all of the details. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And Faith No Brain On will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.